I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Years ago, a man got mugged by a couple of young men on the street in KCK, not too far from his church and his home. That's an unremarkable story, except that this man would be moved to respond not with vengeance, but with compassion. Today we learn about him and the mentoring and tutoring program he started, which serves kids from low-income homes at four sites around the city. And later, we'll check in on marijuana in Missouri. As more and more states make weed legal for medicinal or recreational use, advocates have fallen short so far in the Show Me State, but they aren't giving up. All that in the latest State House Blend Missouri will get you up to date after this hour's news. Poverty, crime, struggling schools, they're problems that affect many neighborhoods, including parts of Kansas City, Kansas, and they have for years. Governments, churches, police, more than a few crime victims have tried to respond in a variety of ways, but one man took a bad experience 14 years ago and turned it into a project that's touching hundreds of kids' lives. Brad Grabs is the founder and executive director of Learning Club KC. Hi, Brad.
Good morning, Brian.
Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with that story, that bad experience 14 years ago that has become so integral to what happened after.
Sure. I moved to Kansas City to teach at Rockhurst High School, and I lived in the urban core of Kansas City, Kansas. On a Sunday afternoon, I went for a walk near my home in a park at 18th and Parallel. And I noticed two young men, teenagers, presumably, starting to follow me. I had a bad feeling about it. Long story short was I was mugged and assaulted. A very difficult experience left me pretty angry and fearful for some time. But as I reflected on that experience and prayed about it, what I came to conclude was that these two youngsters were probably not bad kids, probably just in a bad situation. And as I started to ask around in that area, you know, what programs are available for kids in that area to be on a good path? There really weren't very many. And so I had the idea that maybe that I needed to address the needs of the kids in that community, which seemed to be more urgent than the kids I was working with at the time.
I have to think that a lot of people would not have responded that way. I mean, what do you attribute that sort of, shift in thinking to get over the feeling hurt or the feeling angry?
Yeah, I don't know. I've always had a heart for people on the margins. And when I was teaching at Rockhurst High School, I was really even challenged by my students, because they knew my beliefs, to live them out more fully.
What did you teach?
I taught theology.
Oh, well, there you go then.
Yeah. And so I really had that desire to not only, teach about helping people on the margins, but I really felt a call to actually live it out.
And you had to leave teaching to fully invest yourself in this?
Right. So I left about a year later. I ended my time with Rockhurst and started the Learning Club. And for several years, I just did it part-time. I had other part-time work. And our site was at the former Blessed Sacrament Grade School at 24th and Parallel. And then I had an experience that really made me think that we needed to do even more with students in that area. I participated in a police ride along, and we were on patrol, and the officer I was with got a call for a domestic disturbance in Juniper Gardens public housing complex. And we took off red light and siren down Parallel, but three blocks before we got to Juniper Gardens, he stopped the car and pulled over to the side. And I looked at him, and he said, "We never go here alone. I've got to wait for backup." So we waited for two more patrol cars to come before they would even enter the complex. And fortunately, the problem wasn't that severe. It was a fight that had started in a home and spilled out into the yard. But what I noticed was lots of kids there. Kids playing, some of them were watching this whole thing unfold, but just lots of kids everywhere. And it really struck me as a very sad statement about our community that an area where police are afraid to enter, lots of our children are growing up. And I felt at that time that we needed to do more. And from there, I went to the housing authority, who's in charge of Juniper Gardens, and asked them if I could have a learning club program there. And they were thrilled, and we've been there for 5 years.
So how did that happen, that process of moving from, hey, this is an idea, or I feel moved by compassion to do something, to actually putting this together enough to have a program, to seeking financial support to do it, to actually mm-hmm. getting an actual mentoring situation started?
Sure. Well, we've really been blessed to have some wonderful people involved with the Learning Club. I take very little credit for what it has become because we have over 100 people from throughout the metro area that are involved with our kids every week as tutors and mentors. We serve about 120 kids a week. And we just have some of the best people that I know who have opened their hearts to work with our students. And they're also, I would have to say, some of the bravest people that I know because a lot of people would be afraid to go to Juniper Gardens, for example, and we work in three other public housing sites. And there, a lot of them have reputations of being difficult places to be and maybe unsafe. But our folks, I'm so proud of them because they feel more strongly about caring for our kids than they are concerned for their own safety. They want to be there. And really, our success has been due to their commitment to the kids.
Yeah, it strikes me that a lot of these kinds of programs might be at a school somewhere with a more controlled environment. But you're mm-hmm. actually sending people into these sites that are right in the housing projects.
That's right. And that's very important to us to be where the kids are because we really have a passion to reach the most marginalized kids. And we know that the kids who are most marginalized lack two things, transportation and parental involvement. And so when we go to where the kids are, then we don't have to worry about transportation. We don't have to worry about parents bringing them or even being very involved. At each of those sites, we operate on the grounds of the public housing complex. And so the kids just come to us after school right there where they live, and we work with them. And it's been a great arrangement.
Were there challenges you did not expect in putting this together from the time it came together in your head to the time you were putting flesh on it?
Yeah, there have been. I mean, we're constantly seeking ways to improve it, to be more, to reach out to the kids better. And it's an ongoing process, but we've been able to adapt to a lot of those challenges.
Give me an example. What's a challenge you had to overcome?
Well, initially, when we started at Juniper Gardens, the kids that came, I don't think they expected to have a good quality program available to them. And it took some time for them to understand that we were going to be there for the long haul. There had been some other kids' programs there that had started and stopped for a variety of reasons. And it really took some time for them to know that we were going to be there consistently over time and to build up a solid foundation of kids that would come consistently.
How many kids are involved in this at this point?
We serve about 120 kids a week.
At how many different sites?
Five.
Wow. And how many staff do you have running that?
We're a pretty bare-bones organization. So there are two of us that are full-time and then three other part-time people, but we're all either current or former educators. And like I said, most importantly, we've got an awful lot of volunteers that help.
At what point did it start to feel like a success, or does it feel like a success? Maybe that's a better question.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, it's kind of interesting how you define success. We definitely focus on academics. A lot of our students are, for lots of different reasons, they are behind in their fundamental skills in reading, writing, and math. And so we work on that. That's kind of the foundation of what we do. And we've seen progress in the kids. Of course, not as much as we'd like. We'd always like to see the kids make more progress. But what to me feels very successful that I think that we sometimes overlook to mention is what I call the unlikely friendships that develop in the Learning Club. So we have students from all different backgrounds. We have refugee kids, Muslim refugee kids. We've got kids who have been trapped in generational poverty for a long time. We've got kids who are undocumented, all different kinds of kids. And we're able to pair them with people throughout the metro area that come from very different backgrounds. We have folks that come after work from Security Bank, for example. We've got people who are retired teachers, retired physician from Lenexa that comes, business owners, and they come to work with our kids. And I think it's beautiful to see those relationships develop. Most of the time, we're able to keep the student and the tutor matched up. And so over time, they really form a bond of friendship and respect for one another that really brings our community together.
You know, you mentioned some of the factors at play here, the poverty that you're dealing with and the kids who are behind in skills. And you might think, well, those are systemic problems. Those are solved by schools and funding for schools, by social welfare programs.
Sure.
You're just tackling this little tiny slice of the lives of really a tiny slice of the people. A lot of people would say that isn't really having that much impact.
Yeah. Well, I think we're having a profound impact on the kids that we do work with, you know, and we've seen that. We've seen some of our kids have been with us for years. A lot of our tutors have been with us for many years. And I've seen that transformation not only in academics, but in our students who maybe for the first time have an adult in their life who is really a mature, responsible, caring adult who's a good model for them, and they can really look up to that person. And that there's no doubt in my mind that truly can be a transformational experience for young people.
Are the mentors who come in, are they coming from outside of the community? Are they living in the heart of the community as you were when this all got started?
Right. We do have a few of our volunteers from the urban core in our staff, but most of our volunteers come from the suburbs, Johnson County, north of the river, all over the place. And so, again, it's an opportunity for people from a very different background to connect with some of our kids. And I think it's been it's really helped them to grow in respect for one another.
I'm sure that that's an exposure that for many of these kids, they don't know anyone else from those suburbs. And maybe it goes the other way, too. It's a new experience for the people coming in. What's the experience like for these volunteers? How are they changed by what happens there?
Yeah, I think it really, you know, we did a survey of our tutors just to get some feedback. And one of the things that we asked them was how strongly do you agree with this statement that participating in Learning Club has expanded the scope of what I consider to be my community. And 88% of our tutors and mentors said that they agreed or strongly agreed that, yes, this experience had expanded the scope of what they considered to be their community. And so, you know, when we hear on the news of some violence in one of the public housing complexes at Juniper Gardens, for example, people used to, you know, just kind of turn that kind of news off, right? But now the people who are involved there, I'm getting emails and calls when people hear that, and they say, is that one of our students? Is that somebody, a family that we know? People are concerned about what's happening in the urban core because they know somebody. They have a personal connection to people that live there.
Something that was invisible to them before now.
Right, yeah. It really puts a face on poverty and people who live in the urban core.
Does it concern you that and I don't know, I'm judging from you're saying that the folks are coming from Johnson County and the Northlands, so this may not be true, but I'm gathering that demographically the people who are coming and doing the tutoring maybe are of higher income levels,
yes,
maybe different race than a lot of the students they're tutoring. Does that mm-hmm. bother you? Would you like to be cultivating more leadership from within the community?
Sure. You know, that's a very good point. We're open really to anybody and everybody to work with our kids. As long as they care about kids and want to be a good example for them, we welcome everybody. And yeah, we do have people from the urban core that work with our students. And that's a very good thing too. It's important for the kids to see people from different backgrounds who are willing to help and be in relationship with them as well.
I do want to ask you about sort of the political realities in Kansas right now, which have meant, generally speaking, less support for poverty relief programs, for less funding for public schools, including some pretty substantial hits in Wyandotte County.
Right.
How does that affect your work?
Yeah. You know, fortunately, we don't rely on government funding. We never have. And it's been, I've been pretty clear in my mind, at least, about that. And mostly it's because I don't want our program to be dependent on the political whims in Topeka or in Washington. We want to be a stable presence for our students over the long haul. But I will say that to me it seems very, very obvious that where there's a greater need, there needs to be a greater investment. And I'll give you an analogy. My family lives in the urban core. And any window of our house that you look out, you see three types of houses. You see some houses that are well-maintained, nice homes. You see some houses that are pretty distressed. And you see some other houses that are completely abandoned. And even if I don't know anything about the owners of those homes, I can tell you that the well-maintained homes have had investment. People have been investing in those homes to keep them up and to make sure that they're still in good condition. The distressed homes, I can tell you that the owners aren't investing. They're not putting what needs to be invested to maintain the integrity of the home. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the ones that are completely abandoned, people have cut and run. They've just decided to completely walk away. And I think the same is true with education and social services as well, that where there's a greater need, we have to realize that there must be a greater investment, because if we don't, maybe, you know, in the short term, you may not see that much of an impact when you reduce the investment. But over the long term, just like in a distressed home, if you don't invest in your home, it's going to see decay.
That's Brad Grabs. He's founder and executive director of the Learning Club at KCK. Brad, thank you so much for the important work you're doing and for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, the 2016 elections were good for marijuana legalization supporters around the country, but not so much around here. Some Missourians want to change that, and we'll talk to a couple of them when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, the importance of building an audience for the arts. You can find that online. Also, a musician's story on how to unlock the creative mind. It's all at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the future of the Affordable Care Act and also of aging in America. We'll talk with a former member of the Obama administration. That's tomorrow. But today, 29 states plus the District of Columbia. That's how many states now allow marijuana use in some form, most for medicinal purposes, but 8 of those allow people to possess small amounts of pot for recreational use, too. Notably absent from the list, Missouri, as well as Kansas, but not for lack of trying. And advocates in the Show Me State say they aren't done trying yet. Joining us this morning to talk about that effort are leaders in two different organizations. Jack Cardetti is spokesman for New Approach Missouri. Hi, Jack.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. And Ryan Flowers, he's on the board of Normal KC. That's the Kansas City chapter of the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws. Hi, Ryan.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So let me start with you, Jack. New Approach Missouri organized the effort to pass a ballot measure this year. It fell short of the required number of signatures. Remind us what that initiative would have done.
Oh, sure. It was a basic medical marijuana ballot initiative. And what it really did is it put doctors and patients back in control of their medical treatment options. Like you said, 27 states now allow doctors and patients with debilitating illnesses to make the decision on whether medical marijuana is the correct treatment option for them or whether or not. In a state like Missouri, unfortunately, we have bureaucrats, we have politicians making those healthcare decisions. We need to get out of the government out of that and put doctors and patients back in charge.
So the initiative got presented, but it didn't get on the ballot. Talk about why.
Well, sure. New Approach Missouri was sort of the first big effort in the state to push this forward. We came up short on the number of signatures in one of the 6 congressional districts that we collected in. Now, obviously, that was disappointed, but I think because it was such a credible effort, because it had so much support behind it, I think what we really have done is put this on the we've put this on the path to being passed by the voters of Missouri, and we have filed another one. And so hopefully this will be on the November of 2018 ballot. Missourians are excited about this because tens of thousands of our loved ones, of our coworkers, of our family members, they're suffering with these debilitating diseases, and they can't even have the conversation with their doctor right now whether it might be appropriate for them.
I do want to talk about kind of what your organization will be doing between now and the potential next time that it's on the ballot. I guess I'm curious, though, whether you think the initiative would have passed. I mean, this turned out to be a pretty conservative electorate in Missouri a couple weeks ago, a 19-point victory for Donald Trump in Missouri. Do you think you might have dodged a bullet by not having it on the ballot?
No, not at all. We wish we would have been on the ballot, because when you say it's a conservative electorate, but what it really was a libertarian electorate. You know, you had a lot of voters that are fed up with Washington. They're fed up with business as usual. They want to get the government out of their everyday lives. That's why it passed this past November in medical marijuana in Arkansas, in North Dakota, in Florida, which requires more than 60%. So we're quite confident that if it gets on the ballot in Missouri, it will pass, because a number of our voters here are very libertarian minded. They want government out of that business and doctors and patients back in charge.
Liberal bastion of North Dakota passed it.
Exactly.
Ryan Flowers, your group, Normal KC, wants to actually go further than this ballot initiative. You're focusing your efforts here in Kansas City, too. Say more about what you would like to see happen.
The decriminalization effort here in Kansas City will decriminalize about 35 grams of flower concentrate in edibles, essentially treats cannabis as the same.
How much is 35 grams?
35 grams is just over an ounce. It's right under the federal mandatory minimum.
Okay.
And essentially, the decriminalization will help treat people here who are normal human beings, who are living out their lives, not like criminals, but as normal people. Instead of throwing them in jail or giving them a fine, we'll instead give them a smaller fine or reduction, and recognize that cannabis usage really isn't a criminal activity and shouldn't be treated as such.
Would it allow cannabis to be sold in Kansas City?
Oh, absolutely not. Essentially, it'll go back to the way they had it in Prohibition with alcohol. You could possess it and you could have it, essentially, but if the police officer found that you were in possession of that, they could charge you then with a $25 fine. It wouldn't be any jail time. You wouldn't have to, have a lawyer involved by any means. And this will significantly reduce the burdens that are often put disproportionately upon minority communities, as well as just Kansas City in general. We had about 1,000 arrests last year just for marijuana alone. And I know that Jackson County specifically doesn't prioritize marijuana arrests, but we still had 1,000 individuals that were arrested. So it's time that we start treating it a little bit more like a normal issue as opposed to a serious crime.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. If you have a question or a comment about plans to make pot more accessible, more legal in Missouri, or specifically in Kansas City, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We're talking about marijuana in Missouri. You know, Ryan, your proposal is focused on Kansas City. Do you have support for that ordinance on the city council at this point?
From the city council specifically, they have not been able to reach us on their opinion. Individually, we have reached out to just about everyone, including the mayor, and we imagine within the 60-day period to evaluate our initiative, they will make recommendations or they'll potentially act on it themselves. And if they agree with our ordinance, they could choose to act on it themselves, or they could allow it to go to the ballot on April 4th.
How do you go about running and planning a city-level campaign for something like this? What's your plan?
We already have a normal chapter enacted. We meet monthly. We have educational videos. And we're also reaching out to different communities. Like, we reached out to the elderly community. We also, with Adventures Unlearning, we reached out to the veterans community with spokesman with Tom Mondell. He's been a veteran advocate for New Approach Missouri as well as Normal. And these different communities all are affected by cannabis in different ways. Mm-hmm. However, it comes to all of these people going to the ballots. We have to reach out to Kansas Cityans on the radio, on television, on the internet as well, if it comes to the April 4th ballot. But we're hopeful that perhaps the city council will want to go ahead and rubber stamp this one.
Jack Cardetti, with your effort being statewide and also more focused on the medical marijuana issue, is it a different kind of plan? You said you've already submitted the the initiative, right?
Yeah, we just submitted it earlier this week. And really, in the next 60 days or so, we will get the approval to go out and start collecting those signatures. You know, what happened last cycle is essentially we ran out of time. That won't happen this year if we start this early, because we'll have all the way until May of 2018 to turn those signatures in. So in the next 60 days, we'll start collecting signatures. Anyone that wants to learn more or wants to volunteer can go to newapproachmissouri.com and get involved.
And your focus, Jack, is very specifically on the ballot measure. You don't see there's any chance of the General Assembly in Jefferson City acting on this apart from citizen initiative.
No, we've looked at the other 28 states that have passed this. And what we found time and time again is when states have taken this to the voters have approved a good, robust law that really puts the patients at the center of the law. When the legislatures pass this, they oftentimes still want bureaucratic control. They put too many hurdles between doctors and their patients, and you get a really weak law like the one over in the state of Illinois right now. We want to avoid that, and that's where we're going to go to the people. We also frankly think that legislators lag behind their constituents on this issue. You know, they're scared to take these votes. They're scared to vote on this. So why not take it directly to the voters?
Speaking of the voters, some of them are calling in. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And from the Kansas side, we've got Jack in Shawnee. Hello, Jack.
Yes, good morning. I'm a business person. I've been over to Colorado in business. I've been up and down the west slope of Colorado, Grand Junction and Aspen and all, and all over to Denver, too. And seems to me there are no problems out there. I mean, they've got the shops set up, and it's very orderly. They're raising a lot of taxes, and I don't see any problem at all. I didn't ever encounter anyone who was high. So it seems to me to be a no-brainer. I wish that Kansas would legalize marijuana.
I appreciate the comment, Jack. I know you two are focused on your particular efforts. Is there any effort being made in Kansas that you're aware of?
Kansas doesn't have an initiative process. The only hope that they have is through the legislature. However, Normal, Kansas City will expand into the Kansas territory if we are successful here. There's also a great organization called Bleeding Kansas that has been leading marijuana reform efforts in Kansas.
Jack also said that that. You know, there doesn't seem to be a problem in Colorado. There's these several other states. There have been some reports of difficulty in interacting with the enforcement around things like intoxication or inebriation, right? There's no breathalyzer test, nothing equivalent to say if you're over this number, you can't be driving. I mean, let me ask you, Ryan. Folks in Kansas City driving around stoned, are you not worried about that?
Not worried at all. In fact, it comes down to personal responsibility. When you take a prescription drug, you know, it doesn't say, oh, you know, don't get behind a motor vehicle, don't operate heavy machinery, you know, all of these logical things that you would do otherwise. You wouldn't do that with alcohol. You probably wouldn't do it with marijuana as
well. Except that some people do it with alcohol.
Sure, and it comes down to personal responsibility, and not every police officer can evaluate what substance you are. You know, yes, they have a means of which you can do that for alcohol, but they don't have that for barbiturates. They don't have that for opioids. They don't have that for all sorts of chemicals that you can put into your body. So cannabis has been found to be benign. It doesn't kill you. And the fact that it is a safe substance, you know, you shouldn't treat people like criminals, even if there is the propensity that they get behind a motor vehicle. We have to treat people like adults and assume that they'll make responsible choices.
Let's talk to Roger in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Roger.
Hey. And so I just wanted to say thank you to all the people that helped squash that, because as a 56-year-old patient with cancer, two different forms, I think I should at least have that option in my treatment.
So you would like to see the legalization at least for medical use?
I think it should be legal anyway, but as a cancer patient, anything that could reduce my consumption of pain medication would be excellent.
I appreciate that. Thanks so much, Roger. And I mean, Jack, what are the conditions? Is cancer one of the things that that people would be using medical marijuana for?
Yeah. So for our initial petition, it lays out a number of different debilitating diseases, epilepsy, cancer, and others that would be covered by this. And the doctor could recommend that. And, you know, Roger hit the nail on the head. We have cancer patients out there, and they're fighting. They're fighting to beat cancer. And what they've said time and time again is we'd at least like to have that option, because when it comes to preventing the nausea or being able to have an appetite and keeps, you know, food down and everything. They would like to have that as a treatment. And right now, patients and doctors have their hands tied because all they can do essentially is to give the patient more opioids. And all of us know that those have a lot of different side effects. This ought to at least be part of the treatment option. Roger is absolutely right on that.
I have to ask, you know, the two of you are sitting here on the same show, but you're working for somewhat different goals. And I wonder how you feel about the other one's goal. Do those of you advocating for medical marijuana use really want to see it expand to recreational use? And do those of you seeking sort of this open access, at least to small amounts of marijuana, think that passing a medical measure would be too much of a half measure that might keep you from getting to where you want to get? What do
you
guys think?
You know, I think what Normal Kansas City and they're doing is absolutely great. I mean, we've seen I actually live in Columbia, Missouri. We did do decriminalization about a decade or so ago, and it's really important because college students, what we had is college students that were being arrested, treated like criminals. They were getting their student loans taken away. Instead, now it's treated like an infraction. That makes a ton of sense. It's kept our community safe, and I think that's absolutely the direction Kansas City needs to go, and I'm proud of the people like Ryan over in Normal, KC.
Feel the same way, Ryan?
Oh, absolutely. And thank you, Jack. I was actually a volunteer director for New Approach Missouri, organizing volunteers. So absolutely, Normal is very much in favor of any kind of reform if it advanced the issues of better marijuana laws across the board. You have to start with the medical argument first, get people used to it, get rid of the stigma, and essentially acknowledge that cannabis has been a medicine for thousands of years. It will always be used as a medicine. And it's important to get into the public's mind that it's a really safe and effective plant.
Just have a few seconds left, but I do want to ask. Obviously, we're seeing a change of administration in Washington, D.C. The Obama administration had sort of issued guidelines saying that marijuana laws in states where states have passed laws, they would not enforce certain aspects of federal marijuana legislation. Are you concerned about that changing under a Trump administration? Attorney General Jeff Sessions has spoken out against legal marijuana. Attorney General designate, I should say.
Yeah, no, look, it's always a concern, but I think when you look at this politically, you know, again, the majority of states now have a medical marijuana law. Those laws are working. They're working well. They're working for patients and for medical professionals. And I think that the federal government coming in and telling voters what to do is wrong. And I don't think politically they'll do it. Again, remember, Donald Trump was elected very much because of this libertarian streak in our electorate. Doing something adverse to the 28 states would really harm him politically.
That's Jack Cardetti. He's spokesman for New Approach Missouri. And Ryan Flowers is on the board of Normal KC. Thanks both of you for joining us.
Appreciate having us.
Thank you.
If you'd just wait here one second. This week's Statehouse Blend Missouri features a look ahead to 2017 with the Kansas City representative who finds herself now one of the top Democrats in the state. Introduce yourself, please.
I am Representative Gail McCann Beatty. I represent the 26th District here in Kansas City, which includes UMKC campus, and I am the newly elected House Minority Leader.
We also have KCUR's newscaster Kyle Palmer.
Happy to be here, Brian.
It's great. Gail, I want to start with what I guess is not a very friendly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
Democrats lost every statewide office except auditor, which wasn't up for election this
Correct.
Year. They continue to be outnumbered more than 2-1 in both the House and the Senate. Jason Kander lost to Roy Blunt. Could the news have been any worse for Democrats this year?
It was pretty difficult to take, I have to admit. But there is a small light in the House. You know, we picked up a seat in a special election last year, and then we picked up an additional seat this go round. So when you look at all that happened with Democrats in this election, the fact that we actually were able to pick up an additional seat is a small light amongst everything else.
It's pretty small light.
It's a start. You've got to start somewhere. We've always considered our party kind of the big tent party. But if you look, we've lost a lot of our really most of our rural members. And we've got to work together. And I think we have a message that will resonate in our rural areas, too. They have some of the same similar concerns.
How much of a role does race play in that? And how much do you think that had an impact on Missouri's results?
Sad to say, this last election, I think, was very devastating to race relations, not just in Missouri, but all over the country. And we are going to have to put a lot of effort into how we build better race relations within our state. This last election was not good. I would argue that it set race relations back through the entire country 20 to 30 years.
I want to talk about, you mentioned the governor, and I think a lot of folks pay a lot of attention once the legislature comes into session in January, but don't realize how much is happening now in the 7 weeks, 8 weeks between the election and Inauguration Day and the start of the new session. Have you spoken with Governor-elect Greitens?
I have not yet. I do have every intention of reaching out to him. He's got a tough job ahead coming in. When you look at when it's a changing of the parties, whether you're looking at staffing, he has to build, you know, his own coalition. We've got a budget issue that he's going to have to deal with right off the bat. So he's got a lot on his plate right now.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you know, we are all here to represent Missouri, and we still have to figure out how do we do that.
And I want to ask you about the budget issue, too. But I guess I'm curious, would you have expected to hear from him by now as the arguably the now the leading Democratic elected voice in the state?
I would have liked to have heard from him by now, but I also recognize with no political experience, I would imagine he is pretty overwhelmed at this immediate moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how about in the General Assembly itself, in terms of your relationship with the Republican leadership in the House? Do you have a good working relationship with Speaker Todd Richardson, with the rest of the leadership on that side?
I think I do have a good relationship with the Speaker. We have vowed that we will be communicating and trying to work together. We've actually been trying to get together this week, and it just hasn't happened yet. But I think that is very important to how we move forward. And looking at some of those things that we can work together on. This is both of our last terms in the House. And I'm hoping that we will actually be able to move some things forward rather than having gridlock, and that we've seen both in the state as well as at a federal level.
So another big thing in the news this week was the reality of a budget shortfall that Missouri is going to be facing. Revenues lower than expected, maybe $200 million or more. Growth not what was anticipated in the budgeting process. And it's up to the governor to balance that budget, to withhold the spending he needs to stay in the black. You were the ranking Democrat on the budget committee last year.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get to the place where the budget falls that far short anyway?
Well, part of any budget process is a little bit of a guessing game, in that you have to project what kind of revenues are going to come in. Unfortunately, as a General Assembly, we work on a budget from, say, mid-January to generally the end of March. And then what you find, if you go and look at what we did in April and the beginning of May, you see lots of legislation that comes through that gives all these special tax credits to various folks for various things. And those aren't taken into account when we actually do the budget process. And so
too many tax credits.
Too many tax credits. And then it's a combination of that and revenues not necessarily being what we thought they would be. We have cut a lot of our corporate taxes. We cut the franchise tax. And when you don't adequately estimate what that's going to do to your revenues, you end up with a shortfall. And that's kind of where we are. Now, there's the possibility that revenues will pick up, and whether or not it will be enough to cover this shortfall, and we don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But the budget it's a moving target all the time. Or even revenues may come in, but at what point in the year do they come in? And so the governor has a responsibility of adjusting that budget to make sure that we stay in balance.
So how would you like to see the governor do that? There's only so many places to cut spending from: education, the transportation and infrastructure things that we've been talking about, healthcare access. Where do you want to see the cuts?
I'd rather see us increase revenues. At the end of the day, having worked on the budget, we have a pretty lean budget. But what we have seen is when we look at our Medicaid program, particularly prescription costs have skyrocketed. And maybe that's something from a federal level that needs to be looked at, is why are these costs skyrocketing at such an enormous rate? So those are kind of things in the budget that are totally out of our control. We have to pay for it. And when you look up and you're at a $100 million shortfall on your prescriptions, that has to be paid for. So when you ask me where would I like to see cuts, I think we're pretty lean at this point. We changed the formula, which I was not necessarily happy with, since we had not actually fully funded. We never fully funded the foundation formula. So the theory,
for schools.
Right.
Yeah.
The theory was, okay, we'll change it so that that mark is lower, but that doesn't resolve our issue. It just gives us a soundbite to say we either do or do not fully fund our foundation formula. But at the end of the day, it hasn't done anything for our education system. As I mentioned, I would like to see us fund early childhood education.
So I'm not hearing any suggested places where there's a cut that can be made.
But I do think we need to look at what do our tax credits look like? And are they providing the greatest benefit to our state? And I'm a proponent for low-income tax credits. I'm a proponent of historic tax credits. But we still have to look and see whether or not we are getting the as they say, best bang for our buck when we look at those. For urban areas, that's typically the only real way we get economic development. But we have given so many tax credits for so many things that it is very difficult to keep a balanced budget as a result of it. And tax cuts. No one likes to pay taxes, but it is a reality of the system that we have, that is what generates the revenue that gives us the services that we want.
Any plans for Thanksgiving?
I have huge plans for Thanksgiving. I have anywhere from 70 to 80 people that are going to descend on my home for dinner.
Are you doing all the cooking?
I do about 90% of the cooking.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I want to thank the guests today, Representative Gail McCann-Beatty of Kansas City and KCUR's Kyle Palmer. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
And the last word is going to be yours, Gail, as you end our show for us with a musical selection of your choice. What should we go out on today?
So my musical choice is going to be Marvin Gaye, What's Going On.
What's Going On? A question a lot of people are asking since the elections. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening. There's too many of you to cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find. You can find the complete Statehouse Blend Missouri on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe, and subscribe to Statehouse Blend Kansas as well. You can listen to our previous up-to-date programs and download our podcasts at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up-to-Date, and I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow on the program, the future of the Affordable Care Act with a former member of the Obama administration and, of course, our holiday weekend to-do list. Our program's produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.